So, hello, greetings. We begin then the 21st chapter in the Life Divine tonight, The Ascent of Life. This would have been published originally in the Aria on the 15th of April in 1915, is it? Or 16. Interestingly, we have a number of citations from the Rig Veda. Let's start with what Sri Aurobindo has translated and recast in his rewriting of the Life Divine. Substantially revised here. Let the path of the Word lead to the Godheads, towards the waters by the working of the mind. O flame, thou goest to the ocean of heaven, towards the gods. Thou makest to meet together the Godheads of the plains, the waters that are in the realm of light above the sun, and the waters that abide below. And then, the Lord of Delight conquers the third status. He maintains and governs according to the soul of universality. Like a hawk, a kite, he settles on the vessel and uplifts it. A finder of the light, he manifests the fourth status and cleaves to the ocean that is the billowing of those waters. And the last, thrice Vishnu paced and set his step uplifted out of the primal dust. Three steps he has paced, the guardian, the invincible, and from beyond he upholds their laws. Scan the workings of Vishnu and see from whence he has manifested their laws. That is his highest pace, which is seen ever by the seers like an eye extended in heaven. That the illumined, the awakened, kindle into a blaze, even Vishnu's step supreme. Now, compare that with the simplicity of his first citations in the Aria. Let the path of the soul to the Godhead lead up towards the original ocean by the working of the mind. That's the first. The second, the great delight of things conquering the third law of status affirms and governs all by the soul of universality. Then, in his winged and wide ascent, he manifests the fourth status and adheres firmly to the ocean that is the fountain of these waters. And the last, these are three steps of his movement that Vishnu has made, uplifted out of the primal dust, but from beyond he upholds their laws. Scan the workings of Vishnu and see from whence he has manifested their laws. That is his highest pace and seat. For that, the awakened soul here heaps the fuel and turns it into a blaze of light, even Vishnu's supreme status. They're both good sets of quotations. The difficulty of Vedic Sanskrit is legendary. Let's go back and look at some of the terms with a little more focus. He opens, let the path of the Word. The Word here is Brahman. And Brahman, as we come to know it later in Indian philosophy, represents the principle of the divine, the impersonal divine. And we've met it in that context, even in the Life Divine. But here, it means the inspired speech, the Word, that is, in a sense, carved out of the heart of the seer, the Rishi, as a mantra. So Brahman is a mantra, but it is the evocative word. It brings into being that which it articulates. It takes from the essence and through the power of the speech brings into manifestation. So this is the leader. Let the path of the word lead to the Godheads, towards the waters by the working of the mind. What are the waters? The waters always represent the life-giving cosmic principles. They symbolize a state or a plane of conscious being. So this creative word should lead us towards the waters as the mind increases. We should move towards the fullness of that. That is all from one verse of the Veda. Then the second citation begins, O flame, this is Agni. As Sri Aurobindo will explain in other contexts, he is the soul center of the psychic world, the devata of the psychic plane. So in a sense, he represents that which progresses, which is ever advancing, which is always growing. So, O flame, thou goest to the ocean of heaven, towards the gods. An ocean, a large body of water, again, above. The flame is going up. What does the flame do? As the leader of the sacrifice, what is offered is taken by the flame upwards, towards that oceanic mean, towards the gods who are waiting for this substance to arrive, so that then through their commerce with the offerer, they can awaken their powers in the one who gives. And then addressing the flame again, thou makest to meet together the godheads of the plains, the waters that are in the realm of light above the sun, and the waters that abide below. So it is through this soul power that the combined powers of the manifesting gods come into harmony. And this aspiration leads us to what is both beyond in that realm of the supramental and those waters that abide below. All are waters of consciousness. All are part of an immense universe, a manifestation that extends even into what seems to be dark and divided. Still, the waters of consciousness are there. And this fire is present here in the act of offering, is present there at the end of the destination above, and kindling itself in what seems to be the dim waters beneath. So, a most amazing kind of fire. The second one, the Lord of Delight conquers the third status, Tritiyam Dhamma. So, in other words, the principle of delight, again cognate with this power of aspiration within us, which we can call Agni, drives us to a third status, maintains and governs according to the soul of universality, that is Virajam. That soul of universality is the wideness of the world. So even though it may appear in us as an individual propulsion forward, it is set within the context of the universe. Like a hawk, this power, this of the Lord of Delight, like a kite, he settles on the vessel, that's us, that's our body, and uplifts it. A finder of the light, he manifests the fourth status, Turiyam Dhamma, and cleaves to the ocean, Samudram, that is the billowing of those waters. So this oceanic being comes into manifestation, comes into our experience. And of course, every time we hear the term Turiya, We think forward to a much later Upanishad in which the Turiya is an expression or a symbol of that which cannot be expressed, but which takes all the various statuses of being, that which is in the broad universe, the visible, tangible universe, that which is in the conceptive universe, in what is beyond all subject and object, and then beyond even that is that fourth status. So perhaps a connotation of that is here as well. And then this last one, and I'm thrice Vishnu paced and set his step uplifted out of the primal dust. Three steps he has paced, the guardian, the invincible, Vishnu being the principle of vastness, and from beyond he upholds their laws. So these three paces are the three steps Sri Aurobindo means to connote that he's discussing here. Those paces, the statuses, being the material universe, the universe of the life power, the universe of mind manifesting in life. So in all these three citations, the primary motif is that of a lifting up and a harmonizing of all the elements, a seeking of unity, a restoration to our origination. So, he said so much just in the translation of these verses from the Rig Veda. And now let's begin with his essay. We have seen that as the divided mortal mind, parent of limitation and ignorance and the dualities, is only a dark figure of the supermind, of the self-luminous divine consciousness in its first dealings with the apparent negation of itself from which our cosmos commences. So also, life, as it emerges in our material universe, an energy of the dividing mind, subconscious, submerged, imprisoned in matter. Life, as the parent of death, hunger, and incapacity, is only a dark figure of the divine superconscient force, whose highest terms are immortality, satisfied delight, and omnipotence. So again, this correspondence, when she has hinted at before, in our last chapter, supermind congeals itself, limits itself as mind to express and maintain separation and alignment of individuating forms. Consciousness force, chit shakti, establishes itself here as life. A life that as it moves has to contend with death, desire, and incapacity. To that we turn in a moment. He then says, this relation fixes the nature of that great cosmic processus of which we are a part. Processus. Originally in the Arya he wrote procession. He changed it when he revised and recast the chapter to processus, drawn from the Latin. It's a word that even in the 18th century was obsolete, but it has a certain connotation. The Latin suggests a going forward, an advance, where a procession might mean simply an empty show. Here comes a parade walking past. What significance does it have? But a processus definitely is going someplace. It's moving towards a destination, and it's moving in a way that is actual measurable progress. So this relation fixes the nature of that great cosmic processus of which we are a part. It determines the first, the middle, and the ultimate terms of our evolution. The first terms of life are division, a force-driven subconscious will, apparent not as will but as dumb urge of physical energy, and the impotence of an inert subjection to the mechanical forces that govern the interchange between the form and its environment. So, division and impotence. By the way, that part where he writes, apparent not as will, but as dumb urge of physical energy, he added as clarification. And also the term impotence is worth our noting there. Pairing that with division, we're back to basically the title of the last chapter. So, again, he's throwing into grand relief a summary statement which brings to life to us, again, what the force of his argument takes us to. Always he begins with a recapitulation, and then later he takes up the substance of his article, of his argument, pardon me. So he's still recapitulating at this point. This inconscience and this blind but potent action of energy are the type of the material universe as the physical scientist sees it. And this, his view of things, extends and turns into the whole of basic existence. It is the consciousness of matter and the accomplished type of material living. So this is the way that the scientist sees the truth of the world as being. By implication, Sri Aurobindo cannot accept that that is a full description of all the potency available in the universe. But there comes a new equipoise. There intervenes a new set of terms which increase in proportion as life delivers itself out of this form and begins to evolve towards conscious mind. For the middle terms of life are death and mutual devouring, hunger and conscious desire, the sense of a limited room and capacity, and the struggle to increase, to expand, to conquer, and to possess. So Sri Aurobindo then sees evolution from above, philosophically, in a grander light, not simply as the mechanical collision of molecules. He has seen in operation principles which continually enlarge themselves, begin working in matter in a certain way, and then continue to work in emergent life, but still recognizable as the same principles, detectable also when mind begins to emerge. These three terms are the basis of that status of evolution which the Darwinian theory first made plain to human knowledge. For the phenomenon of death involves in itself a struggle to survive, since death is only the negative term in which life hides from itself and tempts its own positive being to seek for immortality. So death is an instrument through which life greatens its reach and grasp upon matter. It is not a defeat for life, but it is an instrumentality for life to thoroughly conquer and master matter. He goes forward. The phenomenon of hunger and desire involves a struggle towards a status of satisfaction and security, since desire is only the stimulus by which life tempts its own positive being to rise out of the negation of unfulfilled hunger towards the full possession of the delight of existence. The same thing. It is hunger reaching towards completion, towards satisfaction, towards fulfillment and fullness. Just as life struggles in matter to really establish itself and be unconquered, so the movement of hunger is to, and desires to acquire fullness of being. Then he continues again. The phenomenon of limited capacity involves a struggle towards expansion, mastery, and possession, the possession of the self, and the conquest of the environment, since limitation and defect are only the negation by which life tempts its own positive being to seek for the perfection of which it is eternally capable. So, to push beyond, to overcome limitation and weakness, and become essentially undefeatable, to be able to move towards mastery, to possess that which you think, seek. This is this third phenomenon. So limitation, in all of these terms, should be eventually overcome as life asserts itself and grows and moves towards true dominance. The struggle for life, he writes, is not only a struggle to survive, which of course is the Darwinian take, it is also a struggle for possession and perfection, since only by taking hold of the environment, whether more or less, whether by self-adaptation to it, or by adapting it to oneself, either by accepting and conciliating it, or by conquering and changing it, can survival be secured. And equally is it true that only a greater and greater perfection can assure a continuous permanence, a lasting survival. It is this truth that Darwinism sought to express in the formula of the survival of the fittest. So the self adapting to the environment, learning to work with it, mastering it, pardon me. But as the scientific mind sought to extend to life the mechanical principle proper to the existence and concealed mechanical consciousness and matter, not seeing that a new principle has entered whose very reason of being is to subject to itself the mechanical. So the Darwinian formula was used to extend too largely the aggressive principle of life, the vital selfishness of the individual, the instinct and process of self-preservation, self-assertion, and aggressive living. So this new principle coming in throws a different light upon the whole meaning of evolution. And if you restrict your view to simply how does life work in the material form and don't see beyond its first innings and render all interpretation of evolution into those base terms, then you can never see what the larger instinct is that's pushing forward in evolution, that reveals itself as reason, that reveals itself eventually as the supramental. For these two first states of life contain in themselves the seeds of a new principle and another state which must increase in proportion as mind evolves out of matter through the vital formula into its own law. And still more must all things change when as life evolves upward towards mind, so mind evolves upward towards supermind and spirit. So, in other words, the emergence of mind alters the very meaning of evolution. And even more does that argument obtain when supermind manifests in mind. So we get a more and more enlarged picture about the direction and the inner impulse behind the power of life evolving in the universe. It reveals itself to be a greater and greater and greater existence. So while we might look at it now and say, gosh, I can't see any reason in where the universe is going, I perceive no particular direction, it's only when the mind begins to reach its acme that that becomes clear, that becomes attainable to us, And then we can arch upwards into the greater truth of the supramental, which waits to reveal itself in terms of evolution here. Precisely because the struggle for survival, the impulse towards permanence, is contradicted by the law of death, the individual life is compelled and used to secure permanence rather for its species than for itself. But this it cannot do without the cooperation of others. And the principle of cooperation and mutual help, the desire of others, the desire of the wife, the child, the friend and helper, the associated group, the practice of association, of conscious joining and interchange, are the seeds out of which flowers the principle of love. So, evolutionary advance brings to the front this hidden harmony and fellow feeling, which becomes the flower on the stem of evolution. Let us grant that at first, love may only be an extended selfishness, and that this aspect of extended selfishness may persist and dominate, as it does still persist and dominate in higher stages of the evolution. Still, as mind evolves and more finds itself, it comes by the experience of life and love and mutual help to perceive that the natural individual is a minor term of being and exists by the universal. So, as we grow, we see that there is this vast context in which we live, and we thrive best when we move in concert with it, when we discover that we are an aspect of that larger being. All are aspects, portions of that larger being. So this experience of love in us is the very expression of this hidden power of delight that moves back towards reunification, towards communion, towards fulfillment in oneness. Somewhere, Mother, speaking about love, said, at first love is like, okay, you love me, and I'll see if I love you. And then, I'll love you only as long as you love me. But moves eventually to the experience of love where it isn't even, I'll love you whether you love me or not, which is the third status, but I am love. So just that. All oneness, all the time. Sri Aurobindo continues his paragraph here. Once this is discovered, as it is inevitably discovered by man, the mental being, his destiny is determined. For he has reached the point at which mind can begin to open to the truth that there is something beyond itself. From that moment, his evolution, however obscure and slow, towards that superior something, towards spirit, towards supermind, towards supermanhood, is inevitably predetermined. So we begin to awaken to that power of love, and it means that that soul which desires unity is coming forward and will carry everything ungovernably, unconquerably towards that grand conclusion. So, uncloseted from matter, resisting death, and division, moving beyond the clouded mind, we must inevitably arrive at this greater consciousness, which is all reconciling. Therefore, life is predestined by its own nature to a third status, a third set of terms of its self-expression. If we examine this ascent of life, we shall see that the last terms of its actual evolution, the terms of that which we have called its third status, must necessarily be in appearance the very contradiction and opposite, but in fact, the very fulfillment and transfiguration of its first conditions. Those conditions were of incapacity and division. Life starts with the extreme divisions and rigid forms of matter, and of this rigid division, the atom, which is the basis of all material form, is the very type. The atom stands apart from all others, even in its union with them, rejects death and dissolution under any ordinary force, and is the physical type of the separate ego, defining its existence against the principle of fusion in nature. So if we look for an analog between what we experience psychologically as ego and ourselves, or we're divided from everything else, we find it at the material level in the atom, which thinks it's different, separate from. But, Sri Aurobindo writes, unity is as strong a principle in nature as division. It is indeed the master principle of which division is only a subordinate term. And to the principle of unity, every divided form must therefore subordinate itself in one fashion or another by mechanical necessity, by compulsion, by assent or inducement. So whether you agree to do it or not, you are bound with everything. Just as in the Gita, Krishna says, you will offer, you are part of a universal exchange of energy, which we call sacrifice. You can sacrifice willingly, but whether you will it or no, energy comes from you, given to the world. You take back. You can make it a conscious exchange and benefit from that, or it can be extracted, but it will be. Therefore, if nature for her own ends, in order principally to have a firm basis for her combinations and a fixed seat of forms, allows the atom ordinarily to resist the process of fusion by dissolution, she compels it to subserve the process of fusion by aggregation. The atom, as it is the first aggregate, is also the first basis of aggregate unities. So he has just described the physical status. And if the atom represents the ego, still it really exists within a broad network, within a larger aggregation, which is part of a still larger aggregation, which is part of the universe. The atom is never really divided from anything. It is the basis of operation and meant, of course, to awaken to its harmonic construction with all other atoms, no? When life reaches its second status, he writes, that which we recognize as vitality, the contrary phenomenon takes the lead, and the physical basis of the vital ego is obliged to consent to dissolution. So now he begins to describe the vital status. Its constituents, the vital arrangement, its constituents are broken up so that the elements of one life can be used to enter into the elemental formation of other lives. So if the atom is the first aggregate, the vital consents to dissolution as it's manifesting in life, in material forms. It consents to it so that the elements within it can be used to sustain other beings. The extent to which this law reigns in nature, he writes, has not yet been fully recognized, and indeed cannot be until we have a science of mental life and spiritual existence as sound as our present science of physical life and the existence of matter. Well, we might question whether we have even a thoroughgoing, steadfast grasp of physical science, but we have almost none of the balance of which he describes here. Still, we can see broadly that not only the elements of our physical body, but those of our subtler, vital being, our life energy, our desire energy, our powers, strivings, passions, enter both during our life and after our death into the life existence of others. So we are constantly feeding the world and being fed by the world. We eat, we are eaten. To go back to the Taittiriya Upanishad, which was quoted several times in the last chapter, the eater eating is eaten. It is the way of life. This is an interesting sentence next. An ancient occult knowledge tells us that we have a vital frame as well as a physical, and this too is after death dissolved and lends itself to the constitution of other vital bodies. Our life energies, while we live, are continually mixing with the energies of other beings. This describes not a physical commerce. We understand we eat vegetables, and eventually, when we are no more, something feasts upon us, upon our discarded bodies. This ancient occult knowledge means that we're talking about an inner life force, which draws upon the world's life force and also gives out. By the way, the start of this sentence in the Arya was, the science of Indian yoga tells us. He's enlarged it to say an ancient occult knowledge, because this is a recognition that is worldwide. It's not limited only to India, so Sri Aurobindo enlarged its scope. The mother, for instance, had studied a great deal about the occult machinery of nature long before she met Sri Aurobindo and was a master of that inner craft. Again, the end of that sentence is interesting. Our life energies, while we live, are continually mixing with the energies of other beings. And this is a commerce that goes on, and we feel it. With some, we feel uplifted, energized when we're in their presence. We feel better. We go away glad. Someone else comes into our presence, and we feel energy departing from us. They're drawing from us, etc. So it depends on the nature of one's own vitality and with the vitality with which one is in contact as to the nature of that balance and that arrangement. But always there is give and take. Just as there is at the physical level, there is at the vital level. And we'll leave Sri Aurobindo to describe the rest in forthcoming pages. To continue, a similar law governs the mutual relations of our mental life with the mental life of other thinking creatures. There is a constant dissolution and dispersion, and a reconstruction affected by the shock of mind upon mind with a constant interchange and fusion of elements. Interchange, intermixture, and fusion of being with being is the very process of life, a law of its existence. So this is an aspect of all that we experience constantly, whether we are based in the body, in our vitality, or in our mentality. This exchange and commerce, this offering, this reception, is constantly occurring. It is endless. It is the very mechanism by which life operates in the universe. It reveals still greater fluidity and commonality than we would see, even if we think of how vast the universe is and how embedded in oneness it is. This reveals dimension and dimension above and behind the world that we see and have contact with. We are having contact with inner dimensions of the universe incessantly. We are vaster in our own being and more sophisticated than the physical view of the world can see and the physical interpretation of evolution can state. I think we've gone probably far enough in this first part of this chapter. So let's put our bookmarks there. And on this summer solstice, on this first day of summer, read another section from Sri Aurobindo's epic poem, Savitri. This is only a little farther into Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, the Kingdoms of the Little Life, than we met last time. All nature's longing drive, none can resist, comes surging through the blood and quickened sense. An ecstasy of the infinite is her cause. It turns in us to finite loves and lusts, the will to conquer and have, to seize and keep, to enlarge life's room and scope and pleasure's range, to battle and overcome and make one's own, the hope to mix one's joy with others' joy, a yearning to possess and be possessed, to enjoy and be enjoyed, to feel, to live. Here was its early brief attempt to be, its rapid end of momentary delight, whose stamp of failure haunts all ignorant life, inflicting still its habit on the cells. The phantom of a dark and evil start, ghost-like, pursues all that we dream and do. Although on earth are firm established lives, a working of habit or a sense of law, a steady repetition in the flux, yet are its roots of will ever the same. These passions are the stuff of which we are made. This was the first cry of the awaking world. It clings around us still and clamps the gun. Even when reason is born and soul takes form, in beast and reptile and in thinking man, it lasts and is the fount of all their life. This too was needed, that breath and living might be. The spirit, in a finite, ignorant world, must rescue so its prisoned consciousness, forced out in little jets at quivering points from the inconscience sealed infinitude. Then slowly it gathers mass, looks up at light. This nature lives tied to her origin. A clutch of nether force is on her still. Out of unconscious depths her instincts leap. A neighbor is her life to insentient naught. Under this law, an ignorant world was made. And there will be other and still lovelier sections of Savitri, which we shall read, forthcoming. Namaste. Jai Ma.